Welcome back to Macabre, a dark history podcast. Our journey into the heart of Victorian London's terror continues. The horror unleashed upon Whitechapel was not a fleeting nightmare. It was a relentless descent into darkness. In this episode, we witness the Ripper's depravity escalate, the tendrils of fear tighten their grip on the city, and the desperate hunt for this phantom killer intensifies. The relative quiet that followed the murder of Polly Nichols was a mere prelude to the storm that was about to break. The citizens of Whitechapel, still reeling from the shock, were about to be plunged into a fresh wave of terror. The Ripper was not finished. Just a week after Polly Nichols' brutal demise, on September 8th, the Ripper struck again. His next victim was Annie Chapman, a woman whose life, like Polly's, was marked by hardship and struggle. Annie, 47 years old, met a fate even more gruesome than her predecessor. Her body, discovered in the backyard of 29 Hanbury Street, bore wounds that spoke of a killer reveling in his depravity. Annie, originally Annie Smith, had also fallen on desperate times. She, too, had separated from her husband and wrestled with the demons of alcoholism. Like Polly, she sought refuge in the anonymity of common lodging houses and sold her body for fleeting moments of respite from the relentless grip of poverty. Her story is a testament to the brutal realities faced by women in the unforgiving landscape of Whitechapel. Annie Chapman's life was a slow descent into despair. Born Annie Smith in London in 1841, she married John Chapman in 1869, and for a time, they carved out a semblance of stability, raising several children. But the relentless pressures of poverty and John's failing health chipped away at their fragile existence. Around 1886, their paths diverged, leaving Annie to navigate the treacherous currents of London's East End alone. The separation from her husband marked a turning point in Annie's life, a descent into a darker reality. The bottle became her solace, a temporary escape from the gnawing hunger and the crushing weight of loneliness. She drifted between common lodging houses, paying for a single night's shelter, her life a precarious balancing act. Like so many women in her desperate circumstances, she turned to prostitution, though it's believed she did so sparingly, perhaps with a sense of resignation rather than by choice. Those who knew her spoke of a quiet, reserved woman who sought to avoid trouble in the world that offered very little kindness. The details surrounding Annie Chapman's death are a chilling reminder of the Ripper's escalating brutality. She was last seen alive in the early hours of September 8, 1888. Around 6 a.m., her ravaged body was discovered in the backyard of 29 Hanbury Street, a grim tableau that would haunt the memories of those who witnessed it. Annie's body was found lying on her back, her legs drawn up, her feet resting on the ground. Her dress was lifted, a final indignity exposing her striped stockings. But it was the wounds inflicted upon her that revealed the true horror of the Ripper's actions. Her throat was deeply cut, the wounds stretching from left to right, nearly severing her head in a grotesque parody of a final embrace. But the mutilation did not end there. Her abdomen was savagely opened, her intestines partially removed and draped over her shoulder, a macabre display of the killer's cruelty. Part of her uterus was missing, a chilling detail that suggested the killer had taken it as a trophy, a grotesque memento of his depravity. The scene was eerily devoid of the expected amount of blood, a chilling testament to the killer's precision and the possibility that the mutilations were inflicted after death, a detail that mirrored the grim circumstances of Polly Nichols' demise. Adding to this unsettling tableau, some of Annie's meager belongings, a few coins, a comb, and a piece of envelope with the letter M, were arranged neatly near her feet, a bizarre and disturbing detail that offered no comfort amidst the horror. The mutilations inflicted upon Annie Chapman went far beyond the act of killing. They spoke of a savage rage, a calculated depravity, and a chilling fascination with the inner workings of the human body, a detail that echoed the earlier murder of Polly Nichols. The killer seemed to be growing bolder, his actions more deliberate, his thirst for violence insatiable. The police investigation into Annie Chapman's murder, like the investigation into Polly Nichols' death, was hampered by the limitations of the era. The crime scene, though meticulously examined, yielded little in the way of tangible evidence. The transient nature of Annie's life, her movement between lodging houses, made it difficult for investigators to reconstruct her final days and identify potential suspects. Yet, amidst the chaos and confusion, a few key witnesses emerged, their accounts offering fleeting glimpses into the shadows of that night. Elizabeth Long. This woman claimed to have seen Annie Chapman in the company of a man outside 29 Hanbury Street shortly before her murder. Her description of the man, however, was frustratingly vague, a whisper in the dark that offered no solid lead. Albert Kadosh, a resident of Hanbury Street, reported hearing a woman's cry of no around the time of the murder. But the darkness and confusion of the night made it impossible to definitively link this cry to Annie's death. Another tantalizing clue that ultimately led nowhere. Numerous residents of Hanbury Street were interviewed, their accounts a jumble of conflicting details, offering no clear path through the labyrinth of the investigation. The brutality of Annie's murder, surpassing even the horror of Polly Nichols' death, ignited a firestorm of fear and panic in Whitechapel. The newspapers, fueled by sensationalism, churned out lurid descriptions of the crime, whipping the public into a frenzy. The pressure on the police to apprehend the killer reached a fever pitch. Yet, despite their tireless efforts, the investigation stalled, mired in a lack of concrete evidence. The police, grappling with the limitations of their resources, considered various theories, including the chilling possibility that the killer possessed some degree of medical knowledge, given the precise and disturbing nature of the mutilations. But without a tangible lead, they were left grasping at shadows. Annie Chapman's murder, like Polly Nichols, became another grim marker on the timeline of the Ripper's reign of terror, a chilling testament to the violence and the desperation that festered in the heart of Victorian London. It was a chapter written in blood, a story of brutality and unanswered questions. The horror in Whitechapel was far from over. On the night of September 30th, 1888, the Ripper unleashed a double dose of terror, a night that would forever be etched in the city's memory as the double event. Within a single terrifying hour, two more women fell victim to the Ripper's blade. Elizabeth Stride, 45, was found on Burner Street, her life brutally extinguished. And just a short distance away, Catherine Eddowes, 46, was discovered in Mitre Square, her body bearing the unmistakable hallmarks of the Ripper's signature modus operandi. The proximity of these two murders, both in time and location, sent shockwaves through London. The distance between Burner Street and Mitre Square is only 0.6 miles, or a kilometer. A distance that the Ripper could have traversed in a matter of minutes. This chilling reality, the knowledge that the killer had struck twice in such a short span, solidified his infamy and plunged the city into the depths of fear. The name Jack the Ripper began to circulate, whispered in hushed tones, etched into the public consciousness as a symbol of pure evil. Let us first turn our attention to Elizabeth Stride, a woman whose life, like the others, was a testament to the resilience and desperation of those who lived in Whitechapel. Born Elizabeth Gustaf's daughter in Sweden, 1843, she endured a difficult early life marked by poverty and hardship. She journeyed to London, where she married John Stride, but their union was turbulent, and eventually they separated. Elizabeth, known by the nickname Long Liz, was a tall woman, her appearance described by some as somewhat masculine. Like so many others, she resorted to prostitution to survive in the harsh realities of the East End. On the night of her murder, Elizabeth Stride was seen in the company of several men, her final interactions a grim tapestry of fleeting encounters. Around 12:45 a.m., a witness named Israel Schwartz, a Hungarian immigrant, claimed to have seen a man assaulting her in Dutfield's yard off of Burner Street. His testimony, though significant, offered no means of identifying the assailant. Just minutes later, around 1 a.m., Elizabeth Stride's body was discovered by Louis Diemschutz, the steward of a nearby club. The scene was marked by a chilling difference from the previous murders. Her throat had been cut, the Ripper's signature mark, but there were no signs of abdominal mutilation that characterized the other killings. It's believed that the killer was interrupted before he could complete his gruesome work, perhaps by the arrival of Diemschutz's horse and cart. The investigation into Elizabeth Stride's murder was complicated by the unique nature of her injuries. Some investigators even questioned whether her death was connected to the Ripper killings at all. However, the cut throat, a hallmark of the Ripper's methods, and the proximity in time and location to the other murders led most to believe that she too had fallen victim to the same hand. The police, in their relentless pursuit of the killer, interviewed countless witnesses and scoured the area. But as with the other cases, their efforts yielded no conclusive leads. Now let us turn our attention to the second victim of that horrific night, the double event, Catherine Eddowes. Born Catherine Conway in Wolverhampton in 1842, her life had a tumultuous journey marked by poverty, alcoholism, and periods of homelessness. She adopted various aliases, including Kate Conway and Catherine Kelly, a reflection of her transient existence. She lived with a man named John Kelly, their lives intertwined in a struggle for survival. Catherine's involvement in sex work was inconsistent. She made her living through odd jobs and even earned some money by singing in the streets, a brief respite from the harsh realities of her life. On the night of her murder, Catherine Eddowes was seen in various locations around Whitechapel, her movements a desperate dance with fate. Earlier that day, she had actually been arrested for being drunk and disorderly, but was later released. Around 1:45 a.m., her body was discovered in Mitre Square by a police constable. The scene was a grotesque mirror of the Ripper's escalating brutality. Her throat was cut, her abdomen savagely mutilated, her face disfigured beyond recognition. Some of her organs were removed, a chilling detail that spoke to the killer's depraved fascination with human anatomy. The savagery of her murder surpassed even the horror inflicted upon Annie Chapman, a descent into the abyss of unimaginable cruelty. The investigation into Catherine Eddowes' murder unfolded in a chaotic atmosphere. Fueled by the escalating panic that gripped the city, the police, under immense pressure to deliver justice, meticulously searched the crime scene in Mitre Square. Investigators collected various pieces of evidence, including a piece of apron believed to have been left behind by the killer. The piece of apron found along with a cryptic message scrawled on a nearby wall, now known as the Goulston Street Graffito, ignited a firestorm and a debate of speculation. The Goulston Street Graffito, discovered in the early hours of September 30th, 1888, was a message written in chalk on the wall in Goulston Street, near where the bloody piece of Catherine Eddowes' apron was found. The message read, "The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing." The discovery of this message raised several crucial questions. Was it written by the Ripper? The proximity of the apron and the message strongly suggests a connection, but some argue it could have been written by someone else. What was its meaning? The message's potential anti-Semitic overtone sparked fears of escalating tensions in Whitechapel, which had a large Jewish population. Why was it erased? Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Charles Warren, fearing riots or violence against the Jewish community, ordered the message to be erased before it could be properly photographed or analyzed. This decision remains controversial as the graffiti might have held crucial clues. Let us now turn our attention to the key witnesses and the investigations surrounding the double murders of Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes. In Elizabeth Stride's murder, our first witness is Israel Schwartz. This Hungarian immigrant's testimony is vital, as he claimed to have seen a man assaulting Stride before her death. However, his description of the man was too vague to be of any real use in the investigation. Louis Dingschmutz, the steward who discovered Stride's body. His arrival on the scene, perhaps interrupting the killer, is a key detail. William Marshall, a laborer who placed Stride with a man outside 63 Burner Street. Matthew Packer, a greengrocer who claimed to have sold black grapes to a man and woman outside his shop around the time of the murder. In Catherine Eddowes' case, Joseph LeWind, a cigarette salesman who saw Eddowes with a man in Mitre Square shortly before her murder. His description is considered one of the most reliable eyewitness accounts. Chaim Levy and Harry Harris, LeWind's companions, also saw the couple, but unfortunately didn't pay much attention to the man. Police Constable George James, the officer who discovered Eddowes' body. The double murder of Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes marked a turning point in the Ripper investigation. The sheer audacity of the killer, striking twice in one night, amplified the terror that gripped London and intensified the pressure on the police to bring him to justice. Yet, despite their tireless efforts and the growing public attention, the Ripper continued to elude capture, leaving behind only a trail of blood and a city consumed by fear. It was around this time, relatively early in the timeline of the murders, that the police began receiving letters claiming to be from Jack the Ripper. It's important to note, however, that the authenticity of these letters is highly debated. Here's a breakdown of the key letters and their place in the Ripper timeline. The Dear Boss letter. This infamous letter, written in red ink, was dated September 25th, 1888, and postmarked 2 days later on September 27th. It arrived at the Central News Agency on the same day and was forwarded to Scotland Yard on September 29th, just days before the double event. This letter holds immense significance as it marked the first time the name Jack the Ripper was used. The letter contained chilling details about the murders, suggesting the author had some degree of inside knowledge. The letter addressed to Dear Boss was written in a mocking and taunting tone. Key excerpts include bragging about the crimes, quote, "I am down on whores and I shan't quit ripping them until I do get buckled," end quote. The sinister nature of the letter, quote, "Yours truly, Jack the Ripper," end quote. This was the first known use of a name that would become synonymous with terror in Whitechapel and across the world. A chilling prediction, quote, "The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for jolly, wouldn't you?" end quote. This is particularly significant because Catherine Eddowes, murdered just days later, had part of her earlobe severed, leading some to believe that this letter was genuine. The authenticity of the Dear Boss letter has been a subject of intense debate. Many believe it was a hoax, perhaps written by a journalist seeking to sensationalize the case and boost newspaper sales. Others argue that the ear-cutting reference lends credibility, though it's possible the killer read about the letter before committing the crime. Regardless, Scotland Yard took it seriously, even reprinting it in the newspapers, hoping someone would recognize the handwriting. Following the Dear Boss letter, several other messages arrived, each adding to the mystery and terror. The Saucy Jackie postcard was received by the Central News Agency on October 1, 1888. This postcard is believed by many to be from the same author as the Dear Boss letter. Its tone is even more taunting, further fueling the public's fear. The famous From Hell letter. arguably the most infamous. This letter was sent to George Lusk, the head of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, on the 16th of October, 1888. It contained half of a human kidney, believed by some to have been taken from Catherine Eddowes. This letter is particularly chilling, a macabre message from the depths of a twisted mind. It's crucial to note a few key points about these letters. While these are the most well-known, numerous other letters were sent to the police during the Ripper murders. The vast majority are considered hoaxes. Even the Dear Boss and Saucy Jackie and From Hell letters have been questioned. Regardless of their authenticity, though, the Ripper letters had a profound impact on the public perception of the murders. They amplified the mystique and the terror surrounding the killer, solidifying his name in the public imagination, Jack the Ripper. The police, despite their best efforts, were unable to glean any useful information from the letters that would lead to the identification of Jack the Ripper. Again, the limitations of technology hindered their investigation, leaving them with more questions than answers. Jack the Ripper was not the only moniker given to the man who terrorized Whitechapel. Other aliases reflected the public's attempt to understand the horror that was unfolding in their midst. The Whitechapel Murderer. This is one of the most common early designation, a simple reference to the location of the crimes. It lacked the theatrical flair that Jack the Ripper would later acquire. The Leather Apron. This name emerged from rumors and a suspect, or a possible scapegoat, who was believed to wear a leather apron. It also predates Jack the Ripper and was associated with earlier, possibly unrelated crimes in the area. The Butcher of Whitechapel. This name emphasized the brutal and savage nature of the killings, highlighting the mutilations of the victims. The Fiend of Whitechapel. Similar to the Butcher, this name conveyed the sense of a monstrous or inhuman killer. Our final canonical victim, Mary Jane Kelly, was murdered on November 9th in Miller's Court off of Dorset Street. Mary Jane, 25 years old, was the youngest of the canonical victims. Born in Ireland, she came to London seeking a better life, like so many others, but was forced to turn to prostitution to survive. Her body was discovered around 10:45 a.m., The room where she died became a scene of unspeakable horror, a testament to the Ripper's ultimate depravity. Mary Jane Kelly's life, though tragically brief, is shrouded in a greater degree of mystery than the other victims. Her life is not well documented. She claimed to have been married in Ireland, but no records of this have ever been found. She came to London likely seeking a better life, but like so many impoverished women in the East End, she turned to prostitution to survive. She was also known by several aliases, including Marie Jeanette, and was described as being attractive and intelligent. Kelly lived in a single room at 13 Miller's Court, a small, impoverished alleyway off Dorset Street, which was itself known as one of the most dangerous streets in Whitechapel. She shared this room with a man named George Barnett, who worked as a fish porter. Their relationship appears to have been relatively stable, although they were both very poor. The discovery of Mary Jane Kelly's body is shrouded in conflicting accounts. Some say it was her landlord, while others claim it was his assistant who found her body. One account states that Mary Jane Kelly's body was discovered by Thomas Ballier, an assistant to her landlord, John McCarthy. It's commonly believed that on the morning of November 9th, 1888, McCarthy sent his assistant, Ballier, to collect overdue rent from Kelly at her room in Miller's Court off of Dorset Street. When Ballier knocked on the door and received no response, he peered through the broken window covered by a curtain. What he saw was a scene of unimaginable horror. Kelly's mutilated body lay on the bed in an almost unrecognizable state. Her face had been completely disfigured. her body eviscerated, her organs removed. Shocked, Bowyer immediately ran back to McCarthy, who then informed the police. When authorities arrived, they were met with the most gruesome crime scene of all. The circumstances of Mary Jane Kelly's murder are particularly chilling. Unlike the other victims who were killed outdoors in more public spaces, Kelly was murdered in her own room. This gave the killer more time and privacy, and the level of violence inflicted upon her was absolutely horrific. She was found lying naked on her bed, heavily mutilated beyond recognition. Her throat was cut down to the spine, nearly decapitating her, much like the other victims. Her face, however, was completely disfigured, with deep cuts and slashes making it nearly unrecognizable. Her chest and abdomen had been opened up, with most of her organs either removed or placed around the room. Her heart was missing and was never found. This was possibly taken as a trophy. Her breasts had been removed and were placed beneath her head. Her uterus, kidneys, and intestines were pulled out and arranged around the body. Thigh flesh was stripped down to the bone in some areas. Blood absolutely covered the walls and the floor, indicating a very slow and methodical dismemberment. In the darkness of Mary Jane Kelly's bedroom, the Ripper took his time, carving what might have been his final horrific masterpiece. The level of mutilation surpassed anything seen before in the Ripper's previous crimes, a descent into unimaginable cruelty. The investigation into Mary Jane Kelly's murder was the most extensive of all the Ripper cases. The police thoroughly searched the room and interviewed numerous witnesses. However, the fact that the murder had occurred indoors meant that there was even less chance of finding any clear evidence. The room itself was small and cluttered, and the extensive mutilation of the body made it difficult to determine the exact sequence of events. Let's discuss the witnesses in Mary Jane Kelly's case. Key witness testimonies from local pubs and shops. Miss Marianne Cox, a neighbor and witness at Miller's Court, said that she saw Kelly around 11:45 p.m. on November 8, 1888. She mentioned that Kelly was very drunk and singing loudly in her room a song called "A Violet Plucked from My Mother's Grave." She was with a man described as wearing a long dark coat with a wide-brimmed hat. Cox last saw light in Kelly's room around 1 a.m. and then heard nothing after that. Caroline Maxwell was also a key witness, but she confused the timeline, making this more challenging. She claimed that she saw Kelly at 8 a.m. on November 9th, after the estimated time of her death. She said Kelly was wearing a shabby jacket and a hat, and she seemed ill. If true, this contradicted medical estimates that Kelly was murdered between 3:30 in the morning and 5 a.m. Her statement was not widely accepted by police. Maurice Lewis, a local pub owner and possible witness, he was drinking at the Horn of Plenty, which was a nearby pub, claimed to have saw Kelly around 10 a.m. at the pub. This contradicts other evidence, suggesting confusion or mistaken identity. John McCarthy, shop owner and landlord at Miller's Court. He owned McCarthy's shop and also acted as Kelly's landlord. Kelly was behind on rent, owing 29 shillings. And on November 9th, when Kelly didn't emerge, McCarthy sent his assistant, Thomas Bowyer, to collect the rent. That is when Bowyer discovered her mutilated body through the window. McCarthy later described the horrific scene. Quote, "The sight we saw, I cannot drive away from my mind," end quote. Other key witnesses include George Barnett, Kelly's roommate and partner, was a key witness, but his testimony was complicated by the fact that he had left the room the night before the murder. He provided information about Kelly's life and habits, but he could not provide a direct account of the events that unfolded on the night of the murder. Neighbors and residents of Miller's Court were also interviewed, but their accounts were often limited and didn't provide a clear description of the perpetrator. George Hutchinson, a man who claimed to have met Kelly on Commercial Street the night of the murder, his testimony has been regarded as suspicious by many ripperologists due to its highly detailed nature. Hutchinson claimed that he had known Mary Jane Kelly for about 3 years, and that on the night of her murder, he saw her at around 2 a.m. on Commercial Street near the Ten Bells Pub. He said that Kelly was approached by a well-dressed man whom she willingly accompanied to her room in Miller's Court. He was standing near Commercial Street when Kelly walked past him, saying she was down on her luck. Shortly after, she was approached by a well-dressed gentleman described in extreme detail, around 34 to 35 years old, about 5'6", pale complexion, with a dark, curled-up mustache. He was wearing a fur-trimmed coat, dark hat, and had dark spats over his light boots. He was wearing a gold chain. The witness also mentioned that this man was carrying a small package and a leather glove in his right hand. Kelly and the man spoke briefly, laughed, and walked arm in arm towards Miller's Court. Hutchinson followed them out of curiosity and stood near Dorset Street for about 45 minutes, watching Kelly's window. Around 3 a.m., he left because he saw no further activity. So why was his testimony suspicious? He reported it late, despite supposedly seeing Mary Kelly with a wealthy-looking man just hours before she was found horrifically mutilated. Hutchinson did not report the sighting until November 12th, 3 days after the murder. He only came forward after reading press reports about another witness, Sarah Lewis, who described seeing a man lurking near Miller's Court, which very well could have been him. He gave overly detailed descriptions. The level of detail in his description is unusually precise. Too precise for someone who only saw the man under poor lighting conditions. Some have suggested it sounds fabricated, as if he were trying to shift suspicion elsewhere. And why was he watching Kelly's room? He claimed he stood near Miller's Court for 45 minutes, watching, which is very strange behavior. Some theorists believe he might have been involved in the crime, or at least had something to hide. The police initially believed him, and then dismissed him. Inspector Aberline initially found his testimony credible and even sent officers to search for the mysterious, well-dressed man. However, by late November 1888, police no longer considered Hutchinson's statement reliable. Other witnesses interviewed include the local pub and shop owners. People who owned or worked in the pubs and the shops in the area were interviewed, as they might have seen Kelly or other suspicious individuals in the days leading up to the murder. But nothing substantial came out of these interviews. The witness interviews in Mary Jane Kelly case, like those in the other Ripper murders, were ultimately and frustratingly unreliable. While many people were interviewed, their accounts were often contradictory, inconsistent, or just simply unhelpful. And there were many challenges with witness testimony. The murders occurred in a densely populated but often dimly lit and chaotic area of London. Witnesses might have seen or heard something but been unsure of the exact location and the time. As I mentioned in episode 1, fear and intimidation was a problem. Chapel was a rough area, and many residents were afraid to get involved with the police. They might have been reluctant to come forward or give accurate information for fear of reprisal. The transient population, with it being transient in Whitechapel, people moved in and out of lodging houses frequently, making it difficult to track down potential witnesses or verify their stories. Even when witnesses did come forward, their accounts often conflicted. This could be due to poor memory, different perspectives, too much alcohol, or even a desire to embellish their stories. Yellow journalism was popular at that time. The sensationalism of it influenced the reporting. The more sensational a story, the more likely it would end up on the front page, and the Ripper murders were the biggest story of the era. Some witnesses might have been influenced by newspaper reports or rumors, making their testimony less reliable. The witness interviews in the Mary Jane Kelly case, like those in the other River murders, were inconclusive. While the police interviewed many people, they were unable to gather enough reliable evidence to identify and apprehend the killer. The challenges of witness testimony in the Victorian era, combined with the brutal nature of the crime and the lack of forensic technology, made it extremely difficult to piece together the events of that night and bring the perpetrator to justice. The murder of Mary Jane Kelly marked the end of the canonical Ripper killings. After her death, the frequency of the murders abruptly ceased. While there have been other suspected Ripper victims, these five murders, Marianne Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly, are generally considered the core of the Ripper's reign of terror. Kelly's murder, with its unmatched brutality, remains a chilling reminder of the darkness that stalked the streets of Whitechapel in the autumn of 1888. Her death, like those of the other victims, remains a haunting testament to the Ripper's ability to evade justice. But the story doesn't end here. The mystery of Jack the Ripper continues to haunt us, to fascinate and disturb. I do hope you join me for the final episode of this macabre feature, Unmasking a Killer. We'll dive into the current DNA evidence, talk about suspects and theories, and maybe, just maybe, reveal the true identity of one of history's most notorious killers.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.